James Earl Jones has a voice that conveys power and authority. He also tends to lend that voice to projects that turn out to surf some of the biggest tidal waves of the cultural zeitgeist.
There is no escape. Don't make me destroy you. Luke, you do not yet realize your importance. You have only begun to discover your power. Join me, and I will complete your training. With our combined strength, we can end this destructive conflict and bring order to the galaxy.
I'll never join you!
If you only knew the power of the dark side, Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough! He told me you killed him.
No. I am your father. Search your feelings. You know it to be true.
No! No!
Jones was the ominous and evil voice of Darth Vader in the Star Wars movies. The Star Wars trilogy has just been released on DVD. This year, Jones also provides one of the voices in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. Yet in his memoir, called Voices and Silences, James Earl Jones talked about all the trouble his voice has caused him. In the book, he writes about his personal life and his varied and distinguished career. On stage, in such plays as The Blacks, The Blood Knot, The Great White Hope, Othello, and Fences. In films, such as Field of Dreams, Coming to America, and Summersby. And on TV, including the miniseries Roots: The Next Generation and his own series Gabriel's Fire and Paris. Jones grew up in rural Mississippi. His family moved to Michigan when he was still a boy. In retrospect, he credits this uprooting with causing his stutter. As a child, the stutter was very bad. In fact, there was a period, between the ages of 6 and 14, when he barely spoke at all. Terry talked with James Earl Jones in 1993.
I did the basics. I was able to function as a farm kid, doing all those chores where you call animals, I think I had my best conversations with the dog, who was a good friend of mine and didn't challenge me in any way. I certainly let the family know what my needs were. But when strangers came to the house, the mute happened. I didn't want to confront them. And I wasn't ready. I hid in the state of muteness.
Did you not want to speak, or did you feel physically unable to speak?
It was just too embarrassing.
Because of the stutter?
Too difficult, yeah. There's some serious framework around the problem of stuttering, but at the same time, although it is totally incorrect for me to say this, politically incorrect, stutterers are very funny. I mean, when I evoked laughter in the Sunday school class from the kids behind me because I stuttered, I understood that. I understand how funny it is, but it's also very painful, you know.
Can you tell us the story of how you started speaking again?
Donald Crouch was an associate of...
Donald Crouch was your teacher?
Yeah, Robert Frost. He was a college professor, but he ended up in this high school because he retired. He was a Mennonite farmer, and he retired to his farm in Brethren, Michigan. And the idea that there were kids down the road at this high school who were studying Chaucer and Shakespeare and stuff, he couldn't stand it, so he came back and taught high school, you know. And he was the first English teacher I had. Not see, I'm stuttering again. He was the first English teacher I had, and he accepted that I wasn't verbal, that I wasn't oral, but he didn't like the idea that I could privately, subjectively enjoy poetry and not sound it out loud. He one day discovered that I wrote poetry, and he said to me, "This poem is so good, I don't think you really wrote it. I think you plagiarized it," which was a shock to me. And I could admit that it was Longfellow-esque, but it was not certainly stolen from Longfellow. And he said, "The way you can prove it to me that you wrote it was to get up in front of the class and recite it by heart." And I accepted the challenge and did it, and we both realized then we had a means, we had a way of regaining the power of speech through reading poetry.
What was it about having words written down for you that made it easier for you to speak?
Not that they were written down, but they're rhythmic. I think you'll find many stutterers today. I'm trying to think of the country western singer who was a stutterer, but does not stutter when he sings. But there are many, many cases like Mel Tillis. Thank you, Mel Tillis. And there are many cases like that, actors, singers who don't have that problem when they are performing. Walk off stage and you can't understand the word they're saying. It had to do with the rhythm. Rhythm carries us through. It smooths out those areas that allow the log jamming and the stuttering to be triggered.
Mm-hmm. So how does the stutter come back very much for you?
You've heard it several times. Mm-hmm. Now, it's always with me, you know. And I have to be careful not to talk too fast.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly becomes a problem whenever I do something emotional, whether in real life or as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
I hit an emotional speech, whether it's a positive emotion or a negative.
Yeah.
Joy or pain. That often leads to overload, and I have to be very careful. There was a time when my acting was affected by it. I think Gladys Vaughn was the first to notice it. She says, when you get emotional, when your Othello, for instance, gets emotional, I sometimes believe you less, and it's because I'm being too careful. You can't measure out emotion. It has a flow.
Could you give us a sense of the kinds of exercises or the type of training that you had that helped you find the power in your voice? Because you have a very powerful voice.
Oh, the exercises were, I got to move back a bit.
Okay.
Sweet, peek, peek, peek. Hog calling. Uh-huh. Cattle calling.
That's something you did on the farm without having to go to a voice.
My dad always said that the reason he became an actor was because even in grade school, and he didn't have a whole lot of it, but even in grade school, he was the loudest kid in class.
From calling the animals.
So he was destined to be an actor. So, and that's kind of true, though. Farm kids are never told, hush, you wake the neighbors. Farm kids are told, use your voice to get those cows in here.
So you think you developed that power on the farm? Long before acting class?
Yeah, and also it is also genetic. I inherited whatever resonating chambers my father possesses. They're not too dissimilar from Paul Robeson and another actor of my generation, Jeffrey Holder.
Mm-hmm.
So when the Darth Vader voice became a mystery, people thought, as many people thought it was Jeffrey Holder as who thought it was me. And that has to do with just the how a voice is produced, you know, how it, you know.
How it resonates, you know, in the head,
yeah,
and everything.
Yeah, in the head and in the body,
mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. In your memoir, Voices and Silences, you devote a total of about a paragraph to Star Wars, to your voice as Darth Vader. And I got the impression that it's not something you really want to call that much attention to.
Are you kidding? No. Not true. It's just that I have very little to talk about.
Okay.
Had I been one of the actors and given points, I would not only be wealthy, I'd be probably much better known.
You got a flat fee?
Oh, yeah. I think George Lucas, first of all, realized that although David Prowse was the actor he wanted, it was not the sound he wanted. So he searched around for a technically and symbolically a darker voice.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually came to me and said to Lucy, would Jenny like to earn a day's salary? The job took 2.5 hours. They paid me all of $9,000, which was not bad for 2.5 hours of work.
Right.
None of us knew what we had. Right. You know, and that was fine. Almost not out of embarrassment, but out of his traditionally his non-traditional capitalism or lack of capitalism, George gave me a Christmas bonus that amounted to the same amount of money. But I was just acting as special effects. That's all that was.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I was having done the Great White Hope film. I'd become a member of the board of directors of the Oscar board, you know, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, at a time when the controversy over whether Mercedes McCambridge deserved credit for her contributions to the Linda Blair's voice, the devil. The devil coming
in the Exorcist.
Yeah, in the Exorcist. And I thought there was a silly argument that I said to myself that all the Mercedes is special effects. And I wanted to keep that clear in my case, so I didn't even take credit for the voice of Darth Vader.
Forgive me, I know this is a small part of your career, but I have to ask you about the CNN voice. The first time someone said to me, you know, I think that's James Earl Jones, I said, nah. You know, there's no way they're right. And of course, everybody knows this now, that you do the voice of CNN. Why did you decide to take that on when you were offered it?
You asked me what is the Star Wars involvement meant to me. What it did, it made my voice viable in the commercial world. But I don't know why. Really, I avoided that great way to make a living and great craft unto itself. But the Star Wars sort of put my name on the A list, as they say out there, for authoritative voices.
So your attitude was, why not take advantage of it?
My attitude? Yeah. Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, why kick something that's going to sit on your lap out of the house? I mean, I think the first commercials I did, one for Chrysler and one for Goodyear and one for Fisher products, audio products. And they asked me to just give us the sound of God. Goodyear Vector tires, you know. Let God sell Goodyear Vector tires.
No problem.
They were not embarrassed about saying that, you know.
So do you have a voice of yours that you think of the voice of God?
No. It just the sound is let it go as bass as it can go and still be clear.
Yeah.
And to sound like I mean it. And there's not a product I've ever promoted that I don't use, including Wells Lamont gloves, working man's gloves.
And of course, the Yellow Pages.
And Rubens dinners out in Rubens chain of restaurants. Orson Welles and Vincent Price and I were once asked to simply, on a recording, read the menu with as much slobbering, lustful sounds as we can conjure. And we got paid for it.
One quick, very quick last question. Have you ever been in a kind of difficult situation, either on the verge of being mugged or given a traffic ticket that you didn't want to pay or something, where you used your big authoritative voice to intimidate the other person?
Last time I was mugged, it was multiple muggings, because my first visit to St. Louis, Missouri, at the age of 14, I was mugged several times one afternoon before I figured it out what was going on. And in those days, you didn't always get killed when you got mugged.
Right.
You got surrounded by a bunch of kids. They said, give me your money. I said, okay. Being a farm kid, what, you fight over some movie change? The idea of fighting didn't occur to me. So therefore, I was quite safe. The only time I've used the voice, though, in my adult life was when I got my first CB radio, and I used the Darth Vader as my handle. Panicked a few people on the cross country drive from New York to Los Angeles, and I've not done it since.
James Earl Jones speaking to Terry Gross in 1993. He'll provide the voice of Darth Vader again in next year's Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith, the final entry in the George Lucas space epic. And you can hear James Earl Jones as Darth Vader now in the just-released DVD box set of the first Star Wars trilogy.